This is the Cider Guide podcast. I'm your host, Eric West. Each week, I sit down to chat with a personality from the wide world of cider. No boring theme music, no annoying advertisements, just engaging conversation with interesting guests. If this first episode is any indication, these interviews are going to be a whole lot of fun. Tom Oliver of Oliver Cider and Perry in Herefordshire, England, joins me for episode one. His ciders and Perrys are cherished on both sides of the Atlantic, and Tom's widely regarded as one of the best in the business. He and I chat about rediscovering forgotten cider apples and Perry pears, his approach to cider making and Perry making, the changing cider palates of women and men, the impact of social media, the challenge of making an honest living from cider, and why the art of cider making should be more like avant-garde music and less like jazz. Here's my conversation with Tom Oliver. Well, first off, Tom, I wanted to congratulate you for the stack of awards you won at the Cider Museum in Hereford competition. It looks like you almost swept the Perry categories, first in dry, medium, and sweet, second in bottle fermented Perry, and then a first as well for single varietal cider. Is that your best showing at that competition?
That is my best showing. And that was fantastic, I've got to say. I don't recall anyone getting four firsts before, but I had the cup the year before, but that was just for one first, which was another Perry. So I've had a sweet spot at the Cider Museum for the last couple of years.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed in the results as well is that Snowdrift from Washington State won a third in the bottle fermented Perry category. Yes. I know when I've spoken with them, they've mentioned you as kind of a mentor and an influence. So it's exciting to see some Americans entering that competition and doing well.
It is, and I have to be honest, they came over mob-handed, as it were, quite a few years ago now, and visited with me, which was great. And we talked a lot about Perry and so forth. And they've gone back and on the Perrys that they have sent over for competitions here, they always seem to get placed, which is an indication of, I think, the high standard and the ability to keep that high standard up over a period of time. So congratulations to them. It's great. And I think everyone should be sending their best cider and Perry over to the UK, you know, because I think we have a lot to learn about what cider and Perry can and can't be, especially when it's made with either different fruit or fruit that's grown elsewhere, you know.
It is exciting to see some of those links being formed between the different competitions on your side of the Atlantic and our side of the Atlantic. So that's something that I hope that will continue to grow.
It is. Well, you know, as you know, I love the opportunity to enter the Great Lakes and to get the feedback from that, because it's all competitions are structured differently and work in different ways. I think it's quite exciting, A, to find out what the results are, but B, it's just interesting to see how people evaluate what it is you're doing and what it is they perceive something to be, because it all feeds into the brain and as to how you do things and what you're doing. And I don't think you could ever get too much information like that either. I think it's good.
And I suppose competition here in the U.S. might be sort of a proxy for how American consumers perceive your products in some way.
Yeah, well, when you think that probably, especially with the more full-blown, hard-nosed, traditional type of bittersweet ciders and stuff that I might make occasionally, if they struggle in a crowd that might understand them, they're going to fail dismally out in the real world.
Right.
So it's a bit of a benchmark of, at the moment, what I think I might be able to get away with. You want to make drinks. I think for me, I want to make drinks that have a complexity, but they also must be enjoyable, and people must want to drink them. And sometimes I think you really do need to know who it is that's going to drink your cider before you make the cider. Sometimes because it's not what sells in one place will not sell in another place, you know, as a matter of course at all.
Right. Well, I would like to talk about your ciders and perries in a bit, but for the people who are listening to this, they may be in any manner of places. They may be sitting in front of a computer or on their commute somewhere. Could you magically transport us okay. to Herefordshire and describe for us, maybe what the landscape is like, you know, what people do there, what the orchards are like? Just kind of give us a feel for a few minutes what it's like to be in Herefordshire.
Okay. So the basis of the Herefordshire landscape is the old-fashioned family farms. And these farms were anything from a few acres, 50, 60 acres, maybe to 300 acres would have been the average size maybe for a family farm, up to 1,000 acres. And these were all mixed farms. So the family would have cattle, maybe sheep. They'd have orchards. They might have hops. So they'd be growing grass and they'd... this would all be in relatively small fields with hedges, based around a single farm and a set of buildings. And this was pretty much what the countryside looked like. We have quite a lot of woods as well, and it's all set in gently rolling hills leading onto the Welsh borders as you come out of England. We get traditionally gentle nighttime rain, and we hope a decent amount of sun in the summer. We can get winters, but they come and go, hard winter every now and then. At the moment, things are a little bit on the change. The weather, it's wetter than normal. The extremes are more obvious, which is causing us a few problems, I think. But the farms are growing in size. The family farms are tending to change. A lot of them are giving up. The ones that are aggressively acquiring land, as they will have to in order to survive, are going up to like 1,000 acres minimum now to survive. We're not able to do that, so we're sticking with our 330 prime acres of Herefordshire land, and very much appreciative of the chance to work on it. But we've got to be a bit more imaginative about how we get an income out of it all. But it's a lovely part of the world. I'd encourage anyone to visit. And if it's like anywhere, it may be like, it's like some areas of Oregon, but with a more gentle rolling hills, not extremes.
Yeah.
That's a thing I think we have. We're not extremes of anything here. And that's really what I think has guided the agriculture. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed in my research is that Herefordshire appears to be one of the least populated countries in England. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the least populated counties in that sense. It's also one of the least income per capita counties in the country as well. So the disposable income of the population is not high. And yet land prices are astronomical. Housing prices are not low. And this goes again, comes up against problems when it comes to the earning power of people here. So, times aren't necessarily straightforward or easy, but I think as a place to live, we have some good schools here. The quality of life is high. It is a bit quieter here. We're still a sort of undiscovered county. But of course, in order to make the most of things, we would love people to discover us, but maybe only for a week or so.
Right, on the holiday, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that leads me to another question I had, in that it seems that you have been at the forefront of promoting Herefordshire and the three counties as a cider and perry producing region. Can you talk a little bit about that and about your efforts to preserve some of those cider varieties and peri-pear varieties that might go by the wayside if development continues on its path like it has?
Well, yeah. I have to say that in terms of the timing and everything, I've come to this after a period of time of just growing up, and not really thinking about my surroundings. You know, there were a lot of orchards, and indeed we had more orchards back before I was born. And it sort of reached a point, I don't know when I started to realize this, but the cider and perry that was available to by and to enjoy was getting really quite limited. And that was one thing that struck me. And at the same time, I was hearing stories about, you know, disappearing orchards and everything. And it sort of slowly crept up, really. You know, at one stage, when I just thought this was the normal way that agriculture goes. You know, one crop fails, you move to another crop, and that's always been the way through the centuries. But this was getting quite dramatic. And though cider apples were being grown, it was a limited number of varieties for boomers, really. So there seemed time for the small man to be able to just say, look, let's see if we can keep this diversity of varieties going. And so, you know, I certainly, by all means, was not the only one. And thank goodness, because I've not been able to plant that many. But it was a growing band of people, I think, and enthusiasts, people with land, farmers with real intentions of being able to plant varieties. And slowly, over a period of 15 or 20 years, there's been a turnaround, I feel. And I feel now there's far more diversity in the varieties planted. There's far more understanding of the varieties that are out there. And we've still got hundreds of acres of traditional trees that nobody knows what the fruit is or anything. It's been lost in time, or maybe it's not a known variety anyway. So there's still a lot of discovery that can be done as well, which is exciting, you know, in itself.
Particularly for younger generations, I would think, to be able to have that world to explore as they grow.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, you can still walk into orchards in Herefordshire and discover long lost varieties. And I did, you know, 10 or 15, 10 or 12 years ago, and discovered this variety of peri pear called the Copy, had been lost. There were no known mature trees of Copy anywhere. And it was one I'd been picking for a number of years, but I just hadn't realized what it was. And then just one day, I realized, and it was like, well, how the heck didn't you get it? But it's just frequently the way it goes. You know, you can be working with a particular variety, and for one reason, the crop looks different every year. It's not like it's described in the books completely. And you think, oh, I don't know. And then suddenly, bang, it's like a flash of inspiration. You find it. I think I'm hoping I found a long lost apple too in the last couple of years as well. I'm waiting to have two or three experts agree with me, which may not happen. But you know, it's exciting.
That is exciting. It seems to me one of those things where it's not something you actively do for 12 months of the year. You know, you're only out there for the harvest, and it's maybe you can speak to this, but is it something where you kind of grow harvest after harvest? You kind of learn new things with each harvest and with each, you know, cider making season. And
yeah, I think ultimately it's like everything that you find in life. You wish you'd started earlier. You wish you'd started noticing things earlier, and
right.
but you don't. And the time comes, and when the time does come for you to start realizing things, it's just great, and you just have to keep going with it. But I find that identification of fruit is fascinating, but also really challenging, because as you say, your time really to identify is with the fruit. And at the time the fruit is around, it's your busy time. You're doing your best to pick the fruit, press it, and run a business and sell your cider and everything. And so the actual time that you can set aside to do all this identification, and it can take a long, long time, it is limited. So it's a real challenge, but it's a lot of fun when you come across something, especially when you think it's an apple or a pear that was destined to make a great cider or perry, that gets to be really something then.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit specifically, besides your own plantings, what's being done to preserve some of those varieties that have been identified so that they can be propagated for the future?
In terms of named varieties?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, on the peri pear front, we've come across, and I've got to think now, there's the strawberry pear, which is one that Charles Martel has and actually Charles is responsible for rediscovering many, many Peri pairs, which has been fantastic. One that I am particularly taking it one with is a strawberry. It's a beautiful little pear. It is the shape of a traditional pear, but it's got a lovely sort of yellowing coat, and it looks succulent, like a strawberry does. It doesn't look anything like a strawberry, I don't think, at all. And I don't think the taste is particularly like a strawberry, but it has got this look of succulency. So whether somebody just thought, when they saw it, oh, this, you know, this looks succulent like a strawberry, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's nice. There's a variety called the Green Roller, too, which he's rediscovered, which is another interesting pear with an interesting name. There's, you know, we're still on the lookout for varieties, too. There's the one that always cropped up locally is a variety called the Late Treacle, which is not a late pear at all. It's an early one, but that one I would imagine if you've got a name like treacle, it must produce a very viscous, syrupy, sweet juice. But you know, we haven't found one yet to be able to confirm that. So that's one we're looking for. And you know, I'm sure there's a very, very good chance that there's a tree in somewhere. In an orchard that's picked, maybe, or you know, a single tree on its own somewhere that could well be it, but it's just not been found by somebody who would know what they're looking for yet.
Right.
On the apple front, there are a myriad of apples, and I'm trying to think now off the top of my head the name of a recent, well, the one that I'm looking for and hope, well, would like to think I might have found, is one called the Eggleton Stier, which is a local apple. Next door village is Lower and Upper Eggleton.
That's fascinating. And I actually live in the town of Eggleston, Virginia. So
there you go. Well, if you drop the S, you can adopt the apple.
Okay.
It's a lovely looking apple. It tastes fantastic raw in the terms of you think it will make a great cider. And when we tasted it a few weeks ago, it wasn't ready yet, but the cider had bags of character. And so we're hopeful. The apple, it's very convincing. There's just one particular aspect of the eye it's to do with the ribbing at the base is mm-hmm. not as pronounced as the old descriptions from the end of the 1800s would lead you to believe. But you know, this could be down to the year, so many things. So I think with all these things, we observe for a number of years, and then we bud or graft from the tree to produce a new tree. And if the fruit from the new tree is true to type, then we feel more confident declaring whether it's been found or not.
Right. Well, since you started talking a little bit about cider, can we talk about your product lineup?
Yes.
So I know if one visits the Oliver Cider and Perry website, they'll see quite a range of different bottled ciders and Perrys. Is there anything that you look forward to making year after year, something that you consider sort of your pinnacle of cider making? Which product or products would be that?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'd be honest, the ones that really give me great delight are the single variety Perrys, because they don't happen every year. The fruit on a lot of the trees is, you know, it may come once every 2 years or three or four. It's very unpredictable. So when we get enough fruit to make a barrel or two from one of these individual trees, that's a real joy, because it's something that nobody else is going to be able to do and or will have done. It makes it very unique, and you sort of feel a bit of a responsibility, really, to produce something that's pretty good. But it's all down to the fruit. Everything I do is down to the fruit, and then the yeast, and I really I really try and not mess with what would happen naturally anyway. Just put the right things together, I think. So at the moment, I have to be honest, we really enjoy making Gold Rush, which is the collaboration with Greg at Virtue. It's a full wild yeast fermentation on pretty heavy bittersweet cider, and then we pitch in some lambic yeast after putting in some more fructose sugar to get an extra degree of alcohol, maybe. But something happens with the tannins on the original cider and the overall complexity in the cider, and it's proven to be a really popular cider. We've just put version 2 out, or hashtag 2 Gold Rush out. And it's a different drink to the first one, but people are loving it. What I quite like is that there's this cider that's coming about every year, and I'm not actually sure what it's going to be, because it's just the result of doing the same thing each time, but to whatever the cider is that year. So it's a bit unpredictable, but it seems to be yielding some really drinkable results at the moment.
I did have the first vintage of the Gold Rush, and I did think it was fantastic. So I would be excited to try the second one. It sounds very interesting.
Good. Yeah. I think it's a little more drinkable and I mean that, not the first one was undrinkable by any means, but this is just a little more drinkable, and it's great fun. But I enjoy making anything. The challenges are maybe to making the drinks that you don't like yourself. Sweet ciders and sweet perries, I'm not a big fan at all. But you know, we make good. The single variety cider that won was a Yarlington at the Cider Museum, and the perry was basically a thorn perry, and they both won, and they're both sweet. So, you know, it's a challenge making good sweet things, because you know, we do it all by palate. We are not chemistry set aware enough here. I'm afraid I'm a well taught by Peter Mitchell student, but I'm a failure on the science department, really.
I wouldn't apologize. I would not apologize for that.
Well, the thing is, it's so useful sometimes, you know. But at the same time, you know, if we've got a palette that we can use, and so that's what we're doing.
One of the things I noticed, there's a video on your website, and I think you are speaking to a group, and you guarantee that if someone comes to visit you at your tasting room, you'll find something that they'll like. Do people often pick the sweeter ciders? Is that what you find when they come and visit? Or?
It's a real mishmash. We're finding, actually, as time goes on, it's getting almost more and more unpredictable. We're in the strange position at the moment where we're finding that a lot of the ladies that come who would probably normally go for a Sauvignon Blanc type white wine, dry but fruity white wine, are really falling in love with the dry ciders. They do not want any of the sweetness to get in the way of the message. And I find that most fascinating, because, you know, traditionally the ladies go for a sweeter thing. The vice versa, the male is proving to be a major disappointment, because they don't go for the dry ciders. They like the medium. Now, this is a huge generalization, but this is a generalization born of the people that come to my place. Frequently, the best exchange that I can hope for on dry cider is with the ladies, which, of course, is great as far as I'm concerned.
That is an exciting development.
Yeah, and you know, it's what's happening. So, that actually is good too, because it makes you think about the dry cider and maybe just trying to get a little bit more fruitiness in there. Without, you know, you can't ever overdo the fruitiness really in a dry one, but you know, try and get it more. There's always plenty of apple skins, I think, in dry ciders, but trying to get a bit more of the pith and a bit more of the flesh in there is quite a challenge on a dry cider, actually.
Is that something that you attempt to do more with, like, your what you call your draft ciders, like in the bag and box? Do you aim to have a little more fruitiness, or I guess like a fruitiness to those? Or?
Well, I have to. If I'm being honest, the bag and box dry ciders, I'm trying to get a balanced blend. But what's happening with them is that we're not making a 50,000 liter batch of dry ciders and then pasteurizing it and preserving it. We're making these ciders all the time from basically we're blending 1,000 liters every time. We use that up, then we blend another 1,000. So there's continual change with the draft in the sense that as it goes through the season, it goes from being a sort of more austere, maybe sort of slightly harder, sharper cider at the beginning to being a milder, mellower, gentler, more bittersweet cider as it goes through the summer until you get to the winter when it's changed a bit. I'm not saying that it's a huge change, but there is a progression through the year.
It does sound a bit like here in the U.S. when people go and visit cider mills and drink the juice, the sweet cider, from the early season apples to the late season ones. You know, the blend does change quite a bit over the harvest.
Yeah, it does. And that may be not to some people's liking, but it's something that we try and champion because we think it shows off the provenance of the cider they're drinking and the fact that it is mirroring the season as the season goes.
Yeah. Well, one of the specific products I wanted to ask you about was the Bittersweet Funk, which I've had a chance to try a few times, just recently available in the U.S. I found it to be pretty challenging, pretty complex. Was that your goal with the Bittersweet Funk, to kind of give something to the U.S. public that was kind of a more sort of hardcore, traditional, bittersweet offering?
Yeah, that's probably the one that's pushed the boundary most so far as the ciders I've sent over. I've sent other dry ciders, but they've been a little more rounded and maybe a little more fruity. This one's fairly typical of a cider coming out of our barrels at about 18 months. It's got apple skins, but it's got the blue cheese thing. It's got some sourness. But also it's got a real nice sweetness at the end too. But by sweetness, I don't really mean sugar sweetness, but I mean just a nice apple-y sweetness, I find. Right. So it's pretty reminiscent of over here we do a vintage, so they're all coming out of the same area in terms of what we're making and how we're making it. It's an interesting one. I was interested to see how it was received compared with the Herefordshire cider, which was a corked sterile filtered cider that went out a number of years ago. And this now is a pasteurized cider, and just interesting to see the difference and hear people's opinions. And I've got to say, that's one of the great things about things like Twitter and stuff. You get a very immediate response to these things, and it's lovely when it's positive, but also it's equally useful when it can be deemed a negative one, because you frequently learn a lot more from a negative one than you do from a positive one. So,
One of the things I'm fascinated with is how you find time to be on social media. I feel like you're one of the more active cider makers. Is that something that you enjoy doing, interacting with your audience, with your fans?
Yeah, well, I do because having done the things I've done, I've always seen the value of finding out what people will like and dislike and the PR aspect of everything. But the fact that this is comes into your home, you can pick it up or put it down as and when you like. It's just fantastic. So I just think it's brought the world into your home, and you don't have to let it, but if you want to invite it in, it can. Because remember, you know, we're out here in the country, and as I grew up, the one thing as a teenager you feel is what a sense of isolation, and I know in farms all over the world, some people love that, but a lot of young people don't like that, and I think all this social media, whatever you would call it, is just allowing people to not feel cut off from the world when they're doing things. So I think that's fantastic.
I think it's positive as well. It's something that enables enthusiasts of cider, since it is kind of still a small niche here in the US, to be able to find one another and interact. I think it's very positive.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's been fantastic for me. Doing this with you and doing all the things, it puts you in touch with the people without having to, you know, go to the expense or the impossibility of traveling there and all these things. So, you know, it's brilliant.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed that you revealed in a recent chat on Twitter is that you were experimenting with a hopped cider, perhaps. Can you talk about that? Are you at liberty to talk about that?
Yeah, I'm happy because we've got one out. We haven't actually done the label yet. We've released it in the sense that it's there. It's in my shop under a prototype label. The reaction to it has been great. I don't know how similar it is to the ones I've tried in America. I'm always, first and foremost, it's a cider. You know, to me, working with the bittersweet apples and everything, it's always going to be a cider, whatever one does. But it's a cider now. There's definitely a hop thing going on. It's nice and subtle. It's given a wonderful sort of complexity to it. There's like it's brought out some of the fruitiness and the acids in the apple fantastically. We only use Cascade. We use locally grown Cascade. But my thinking behind it is twofold thinking, actually. We used to grow hops here on the farm. I grew up thinking I was going to grow hops all my life, and then we stopped. And we took up making cider again. And I thought, well, if anyone's going to be making a hop cider, and sure enough, they're going to have to. They can't ignore what's going on in America. I want to be one of the first. I'm not going to be beaten to the... on this one, so I did, and it's going to get its first airing, this will be fine to say this now, it'll get its first airing at the Three Counties Agricultural Show, which happens this weekend in Morven on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and we have our it's an international competition. People can send entries in, and I've got an entry already from Virginia here, it's judged on the Friday, and the results are done on a Saturday. And I think it's two of the judges this year are people that you'll be very familiar with, Bill Bradshaw.
Excellent.
Bill Bradshaw and Pete Brown are going to do the judging. And accompanied by a cider maker from a big cider making company here. And so they're going to be the first to actually get to taste the hop cider.
That's exciting, a development. Mm. Speaking of America, I know that you've traveled in America, part of it, I guess, through your experience with touring with musicians.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the experience of America and how you perceive cider in America to be, and maybe how that's changed how you think about your own cider making practice?
Yeah. First off, you might not, going to America, I can't imagine anybody who really doesn't want to sample what America is. If you've sat in front of a television for 10 minutes, you're going to wonder what America's really like. So for me, it was a great opportunity to get there with bands. My first trip was ages and ages ago now with a band called Haircut 100 to New York, And we did five shows across America and came home. It was a great experience. But what I think fairly quickly learned is, due to the size of the country, everywhere is really quite unique and different. So wherever you go in America, you cannot judge the rest of America from that one particular city or town. It's this huge variety out there that's quite fantastic. And not just in the weather and the terrain, but in the people. There's a lot of diversity, a diversity that we really don't necessarily directly experience here yet. It's growing, but we don't quite get it yet. So on that, it was fantastic to start. I for a long time I was very disciplined. I did not mix music and cider, and I still don't really mix them. But sometimes opportunities present themselves and you utilize them. So it's allowed me to visit places and meet people and get stuck in a way.
It seems like you've had a very warm reception from cider makers and from enthusiasts here.
Eric, unbelievable. I say unbelievable. I actually genuinely almost feel unwarranted, but it's great when people seem pleased to see you. It's the same over here. It gives you some commonality, some bonding instantly. So you can then deal with the niceties of and politeness and all that, but you've immediately got something to talk about, some reference points. You can get enthusiastic about things. You can bemoan things that are problems. You've got a lot of agreement about things, and then you can start disagreeing about the ciders and things like that. So it's great. It's just great fun. I think people are fantastic in terms of the way they've been with me over there, and I love cider. I love tasting it. And I love meeting people and making it, and I love hearing what's going on. And it's so over there, you've got this, the diversity in cider mirrors the diversity in the country. And for me, I'm envious about a number of things, but my main aspect that I'm envious about is the freedom to make cider whatever you want to make it to be over there. It's not implicit in anything, but it's because of the taxation, because of the looseness, in a sense, the fact that you can make a cider with jalapenos in. It doesn't mean that I think it's a good idea or that I'm going to like it or that I want to try it, but I will if I get it. It's the fact that you can, and I'm deadly envious of that freedom, because over here, you can try these things, you can do these things, but economically, to actually sell them is just crippling. And you know, for my hop cider, I'm going to have to charge more than I think it's worth in order to sell it at break even. And that's simply because of the crippling way the taxation is applied. And so,
is that because it's considered a made wine?
Yeah.
Is that
And it's a made wine at an alcohol level that is either in the second or the third band of made wine. So it's expensive, and therefore what's happening is we've got this situation where any form of innovation is almost stymied and stopped from the word go, and at the same time, it's driving people to do the most cost-effective way of innovation, which is basically lowering the standards that they work to. So the taxation is sort of, it's strange. I'm sure if they made it more inviting to people to innovate and innovate with quality, they would gain more tax from it. But anyway, that's the situation we've got. So I'm envious of the freedom on that side, and I'm also envious in a way, and this may seem odd, but a heritage and tradition of cider making is fantastic, and we owe an awful lot to it, but it's also sometimes a bit like an albatross. And you know, you've got to keep moving. You've got to keep reinventing. You've got to keep things fresh. And it was brought home to me this week by the birthday of one of my all-time music heroes, Ian Hunter, who's a solo artist. Actually, is so enlightened. He lives in Connecticut and has lived there for many, many years. And he fronted the local band Mott the Hoople, which were from Herefordshire. And he's 75 years old this week, and he's as alert and as alive and as creative and touring and playing as ever. And he summed it up. He said, the only way that I've kept going, the reason that I've kept going, the reason that it's still working is I'm only as good as my next song. You know, I just got to keep writing. I've got to keep fresh. I've got to be creative. I just want to keep doing it. And I think the cider world would benefit so much if it was allowed to be as creative as Ian says he needs to be to stay alive. You know, so I just worry, you know, that we are not able to be as creative as we genuinely could be over here. There.
It does seem to be a sort of a fundamental difference between the new world and the old world, not just with cider, I guess, but with wine and beer and other things as well.
Yes. It's true. Though I think, you know, we're catching on a bit on the craft beer side of things over here. But, the thing is that you don't have to like things or you don't have to agree with it. It's just the fact that it's going on. Will keep the whole thing alive and fresh. And, you know, in the similarity of music goes on. You don't have to like every form of music, but the fact that it's going on and new things are being created and formed means that it keeps the whole thing alive.
There has to be a bit of an avant-garde for the whole industry to keep, you know, moving forward and progressing.
I maybe shouldn't say this, but you know, I don't want cider making to turn into jazz.
sort of a caricature of itself.
And lots of very well intentioned, incredibly talented men, you know, whittling around just for their own pleasure. Anyway, but you know, that's good. You know, cider's in a lot better place in 2014 than it was in 2004, and you know, it's in a lot better place than it was in 1994. So things are on the up, and that in itself is great. You know.
Yeah, and it's exciting that I think here in the U.S. that we can look at Oliver's as both kind of as a touchstone, and hopefully, you know, with the things like the hop ciders, we can look at you as sort of an innovator as well.
Eric, I'm very chuffed that you see me as a touchstone. But the word of advice I have is, it's all well and good, but don't look at me as a business in the sense that I'm not earning enough out of this. You know, this is the real challenge for me, is to turn this into something that will, you know, be a living. I don't want to go away on massive holidays every year or anything, but this is the real challenge. It's very, very tough at making cider the way I want to make it and do it to really turn a penny. And so it's, I you know, everyone that does it and makes it work, I am in awe of, full of admiration, because this is tough out there, and you need to really do your sums. I think you need to really think hard about it if you're going to, you know, make your living from it. But I have to say, as time goes on, that side of it becomes fascinating as well. You know, not only do you want to make great cider, I actually want to make a living from it. And, you know, and that becomes part of the challenge as well. But it is tough. I make no bones about it. It's tough.
Yeah, some of the more interesting U.S. cider makers, I think, are the very sort of clever sort of bootstrappers, the ones who are able to figure out how to make the money work and how to get their marketing. And I think it can be a challenge here as well. Yes. It's not necessarily, I don't think there are many millionaires being made here yet either. So it is.
I genuinely believe that there probably aren't. And it's that I think is one of the key ways I'm looking at America, is I'm looking for those people pushing the boundaries, how they're doing it, and how it's working out. Because, you know, we all want to drink great cider, but at the same time, in order to do that, people have got to be able to make money at it. And so, you know, I'm hoping for a few tips.
Okay. Well, hopefully future episodes, I'll have some interesting guests on. So good. I hope you become a regular listener.
Good, man.
Well, Tom, we'll close with that. Thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the Royal Three Counties show this weekend. To catch you up on the rest of the story, the hop cider that Tom and I talk about didn't just win a gold medal at the Royal Three Counties show. It was awarded Best in Show as well, out of 151 total entries. To me, this signals a turning point in the modern cider renaissance. It's expected that a hop cider would perform well at an American competition, but to win Best of Show at an English competition? For more on Oliver Cider & Perry, visit their online shop at oliverciderandperry.co.uk. From there, click on Enter Shop to browse the product offerings, or click on Return to Homepage to learn more about the company. You can also find Oliver's on various social media platforms such as Facebook, facebook.com/OliverCiderAndPerry, and Twitter, twitter.com/OliverCider. I hope you've enjoyed this first episode of the Cider Guide podcast. I'd welcome your feedback. If you felt it was too long, too short, anything that comes to mind, even if it's just to say that you enjoyed the episode and can't wait for the next one. I'm at Cider Guide on Twitter, or you can email me directly at eric@ciderguide.com. That's eric@ciderguide.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join me again next week.